yeah, 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 yeah. Swing along, you can never be wrong when I play your song. And we're back here on Unusual Sources, 93.3 CFMU FM, bringing you the news you won't get to hear in our venal corporate media. We are going to bring you more detail coverage, taking up from our previous interview with Netva Freeman. Of course, Netva is a journalist and activist. He writes for Black Gender Report and other publications. These articles have been very important as there's been a great deal of discussion about events in Venezuela. It's not always the most informed discussion. We're not given context or an explanation of who's doing what. People can't even get the basic facts right. But fortunately, Netva has been taking part in a lot of this, and he can fill us in on a lot of things. And Netva, thanks very much for being available once again.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me on.
Again, it's our pleasure. We've been having these discussions in our community about what's happening, and sometimes there's a natural inclination, of course, to sympathize with people who are in the streets, since there's a number of demonstrations that take place here in Hamilton and in Canada. But we've been getting very one-sided and poor coverage of the events in Venezuela. We're dealing with, you wouldn't get the sense of this from our media, but we're dealing with a popularly elected government that's been reelected a whole number of times. You know, it was a basket case in the 90s in Venezuela. There were massive riots that propelled Chavez to victory. So right now in Venezuela, you have Maduro carrying on Chavez's legacy. In terms of popular support, who's part of this Bolivarian Revolution, would you say, in Venezuela?
Well, it's mostly the poor, the working class people of Venezuela are the supporting the Bolivarian Revolution, and it's simply because the gains, the social gains of it, have benefited them. And so they're getting access to things like education and health care, to something that they didn't have before under the other governments prior to that. And so also the political process, the democratic process, is something they're having access to. They were able to be a key formulators of the present constitution that they have, and they have participatory democratic councils and formations in which they can articulate their concerns and send them upward. Of course, it's not a perfect system. There are all kind of issues, just like with any system, but these things are not a reflection of anything, not a reflection of the socialist system they're trying to build. They're just, they're just the challenges that come with democracy, but they're challenges we can't see in governments or in societies that are capitalist, because they just simply won't implement such a broad-based participatory system.
Yeah, it's interesting that many of the things they're fighting for are things we've taken for granted, like education and health care. Of course, we're learning in North America not to take those things for granted because they're being taken away from us. You've seen, I guess, the opposition as well, because one of the things that you participated in back in February, on the 15th, I think, was you saw a demonstration in solidarity with the Venezuelan opposition. You were there as part of a counter demonstration. So who in America was supporting the Venezuelan opposition?
Well, they were mostly Venezuelans from what we could gather, and they were the wealthy ones who were able to live here, and the demonstration was in Georgetown because that's where the embassy of Venezuela is. And so they probably even lived in Georgetown. They're very wealthy, well-to-do looking people, young people mostly. They were probably mostly students. I would imagine that they probably went to Georgetown University. It was there, or other surrounding universities, but they were obviously very well off and had money. They even paraded little poodles that were dressed in the Venezuelan flags out in the cold, little well-groomed poodles, and they were very adamant's not even the word, just animated, hostilely animated about what they were there for. And so without even having a sense of dialogue or trying to understand, the position of us who were standing to defend Venezuela, they were very hostile, shouting insults and very just rowdy.
Yeah, no, you were able to detail some of those insults. I mean, you and the people there, mostly dressed like ordinary people, just coming from work or on the subway. So what were they calling you?
Well, most of us were dressed ordinary. Well, I have to say, most of us were not. In fact, I don't know if anyone was Venezuelan. And then people have to understand this in context, because most of when anyone travels, particularly from a country that is not doesn't fare well in the eyes of the U.S. government, it's difficult for those who support that country or that government to get here. And especially when you're talking about mostly poor people of a country, like in this instance, Venezuelans, the working poor, working class of Venezuela is not able to just travel to the United States and be here, so you're not going to see them at the demonstration. And now, also the other thing is people have to question, this is something that the demonstrators on the other side would probably, because of their privilege, the mentality that comes from privilege, couldn't understand what would compel us to be out there if we weren't Venezuelan in the freezing cold. It was a Saturday, so it wasn't like we were working class, you know, people, but most of us, but we weren't, it wasn't like we were coming from work, but still, we were out there on a Saturday, and we were there before them, and we were at until after they left, and they couldn't understand us being there, what would compel us to support something that didn't directly benefit us. So for them, they were some of the things they were shouting, like, oh, we know you're getting paid. Some of them were racial slurs. Some of them were slurs about, like, class slurs, in other words, implying that we were homeless people, that we were out there because we weren't, obviously weren't as dressed as well as they were. And they felt like, well, you're getting paid to be out there, and if you come to our side, we'll pay you double, you know, so come over here, and, you know, those kind of types of things. But, and I don't doubt that some of that thinking was genuine on their part, because it's not something they can, you know, the kind of selfish and individualistic mentality that comes from that class can't understand why people would selflessly be coming and stand in solidarity with in support of a cause that doesn't directly benefit them in some way.
Yes.
Yeah.
They're very classist, and I've seen it here in Canada as well. I mean, we've seen Facebook postings where groups were basically demonstrating in solidarity with the Venezuelan, the Bolivarian movement there and all the people. Members of the opposition came and posted and said things like, oh, you'd rather have a bus driver than a university graduate.
Right. And
I've met a number of elites from Venezuela, actually, in other countries. There's a similar attitude you often find, which is that, you know, there's different classes of people that their self-worth is tied to the money. So, you know, if they're not from a university like Harvard, if they work in a working class job, like a bus driver, for example, like Maduro, you get this very discriminatory and often hateful attitude. It seems to be the belief that there's a certain class of people that governs and a certain class of people that should not be allowed to govern. And it feels for them like Venezuela has been turned upside down now, because you have all these working class people and representatives that are able to govern directly.
Mm-hmm. And then you'll find, even in some instances, you could talk to someone, they'll say, well, the Chavez government or the Bolivarian government has done nothing for the country, they'll say. You know, has even ruined the country, has done nothing for the country. And some of them will even concede to the fact that, you know, social services to poor people and less advantaged people have been implemented that didn't exist before. They'll concede to that, but then they'll say, but he's done nothing for the country. Because of the mentality that they have is that they are the embodiment of the country, and other classes and things that are, you know, benefit, it's one, not only is it a waste of them, but they don't matter, they're inconsequential, they're not a part of the country. They are what they would call, I guess, leeches or something, or dead weight, which of course is not true, because this is the working class. This is the sector that actually engages in the most indispensable production of a society. And so they're not dead weight. In fact, the ruling class or the more privileged classes are more likened to leeches, because they actually produce the least, if anything at all, but they reap the most of the benefits of production of a society. And so this is where we can see the mentality skew. They actually believe when they say he's done nothing for the country. They concede that these things are true. They can't ignore them. You can't deny that there's education, there's medical care, there's things in terms of people being able to have a say, a direct say in referendums that didn't exist before. But at the same time, he's done nothing for the country, because the country's different than what these the people who are benefiting and from more underprivileged class.
Yeah, I mean,
definitely underprivileged.
The people that you encountered that are able to dress nicely and have poodles and travel between Venezuela and the United States, I mean, this is what in America we would call the 1%. You know, this is the Venezuelan 1%, yeah. And they're upset that the 99% is taking power. It really goes to show people that, you know, they've become involved in movements because of Occupy, and they've seen V for Vendetta. it's not just about putting on a Guy Fawkes mask and getting out into the streets, because, you know, there's the question of who is demonstrating against whom. And the character of the demonstrations in Venezuela, I mean, there's a few things you can say about it. I mean, you were looking at how they started and why they started and when. This large-scale rioting, from your article, I gather, this happened in the middle of basically peaceful celebrations, right? I mean, the Venezuelan people in general were celebrating something a few weeks ago. That was the...
It was the Day of a Student, and this was in recognizing, it's a kind of like a, well, I won't call it a, I don't know if you can call it a holiday, but it's something recognized, at least not a formal holiday. It's something recognized because it, at some point in the 1800s, when they were getting their independence from Spain, they were acknowledging the role of students in that movement of independence, a very admirable role. And so this demonstration that was taking place in February, it was, the 12th, or I can't remember the exact day now, they were having large celebrations or honoring this day. So everyone who was participating, didn't start off as any kind of anti-government thing. It was basically students. Now you have large and people who are honoring the Day of the Students, but you have different sectors, I guess, of students or types of students in Venezuela. You have those that come from the largely private universities, which are largely anti-Chavez government, anti-Chavistas, as we would say. And then you have some from the traditional public universities that also existed before the revolution. Some, they're a mixed bag, but mostly anti-Chavez, because they're just affected by the propaganda and everything, and they're looking at traditional privilege and whatnot, and I guess trying to aspire too. And then you have the newly formed Bolivarian universities. It's a network of universities across the country that are giving education to, people that just completely didn't have access to it. Those are obviously pro-government forces. Now you have, even in the public universities that seem to be, I won't even say largely anti the government, I think that's maybe too much to verify, but you have people who are also supportive of the government there. Now in this march, it was about the Day of the Student. It wasn't around the government. But there are issues in the country, just like any country has issues, and they're trying to take advantage of these issues. You know, people right now, the media there has been doing a lot to fan dissatisfaction around the rising crime rates. There's a very high murder rate in Venezuela. There's political corruption, as is everywhere in the world, in the country.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that really gets me.
In the world.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then you have the economic things like inflation, which, of course, are not only, you can't really just pin on government policies, but are also subject to international, the global economy. And also the inflation and the value of currency, which is something that's really decided on the stock exchange, currency exchange market, international, is something that can be, to a large extent, out of the hands of a particular government. So while they're blaming these things, but when you propagandize these things and you couch them in certain ways, people who are ignorant of the details and the context of these can be whipped up into other types of frenzies and be made into a force that's targeting something that's not the source of their dissatisfaction.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of those protesting students should have stayed in school. The thing is, things like inflation are not just dictated by forces inside the country, but of course, as you said, international capital. And if you upset capital, as Venezuela has done, there are going to be probably disproportionate economic consequences, and there's some discussion of that. I mean, these complaints, I love the one about corruption, because of course there's corruption in Venezuela's government, and there's corruption in most governments, and it's actually quite ridiculous. I mean, you look at the United States, you can have a fighter jet program go 100% over budget and years behind schedule, and no one gets punished, and the thing goes ahead. And you know, every country, that the more so-called developed a country it is, it seems the more sophisticated ways they have of being corrupt and taking hundreds of millions of dollars at a time. So it bothers me the way that they'll talk about a country like Venezuela, saying there's corruption in the government. Well, yes, I suppose there is. We've got problems with that here too. But with the students that were throwing, Molotov cocktails, I mean, this is another issue too, because there had been complaints about police violence. And as I've said before, the violence within Venezuela's police force was a problem inherited from the prior governments. It wasn't created by Chavez or Maduro. And I've seen too many photos now on Twitter and Facebook of armed youths They've got Molotov cocktails. I saw one demonstrator with a handgun. I've seen people with melee implements, and that's in the New York Times. They interview demonstrators. And there's an article, actually, from the 25th of February. It says, crude weapons help fuel unrest in bastion of Venezuelan opposition. And the interview, this student says, we're not peaceful here, said one student toying with a 2.5-foot-long weapon of some sort made from hoses festooned with nails. So, you know, you have people that are intentionally seeking to get involved in violence, and they've been attacking police and government buildings, and then they make an enormous outcry when police retaliate.
Right.
You know, I think that, you know, this is only after protest, only did we start to see accounts of protesters in general seeking out to engage in violence, and it was hard to deny just because of how extensive it was.
Right. And it's very interesting what you raise about the social media, actually, because this is something, what we're seeing is very similar to the coup attempt in 2002. Actually, it's much more insidious in terms of the violence. They're not only attacking police, they're attacking citizens, anyone who they deem as pro-Chavez, Chavista. And so they're pushing the authorities or the police and agents of the state into a situation where they're facing a choice. Either they respond with force or not. And of course, you know, that's just a very hard thing. What can you do in the eyes or in the face of force, but actually respond with other force? Either you're protecting citizens and trying to do something against people who are, you know, like you say, have all kind of, and it's not just that article in the Washington, in the New York Times said crude weapons, but they're not just crude weapons. I've even seen pictures of people with semi-automatic weapons, you know, like little Uzis and things like that, with their baklavas on their face covered. And so they really have much more than, I mean, look, we're talking about the elite and privilege in the system. They don't have to resort to crude weapons. Venezuela is full of guns and small arms and semi-automatic weapons is the term I was trying to look for. And so there's not just those. And so the playbook in which we've seen in other countries is to destabilize, instigate these incidents and push the government to respond with force, so that then the media can turn around and point to the force and show the force. In Venezuela, the media is largely the private media that's anti the government, so they've been able to take advantage of this and whip up their own citizens or sway the perception of their own citizens against the government.
Well,
not only their own citizens, but also the international, you know, media consumers, and to looking at the situation and thinking the things that are happening. They're not reporting on the pro-government demonstrations. They're not reporting on the calls for the government to tell the police to be restrained from, you know, using force, and those kind of things, which are really speak to the nature more than anything of the government in terms of what they call for, what they do. They would have no interest in destabilizing themselves and doing things that would not make them look good in the eyes of their own populace or in the eyes of the world. So it doesn't even make sense, you know, to think that they would do that. Now, the role of the social media is new because in the 2002 coup, which they used very similar tactics, there was no social media, period. There was no Twitter. They didn't have Facebook for these images to, like, kind of explode around the world. So there's a double-edged sword with the social media in which the opposition can use it to put out a negative and false impression, but also we have access to it, and the people who are on the ground who are able to expose certain things also have access to it to be able to debunk and refute some of the lies that are being told.
Yeah, you know, it's been since 2007 that the United States has been given about $15 million a year to train Venezuelan youth to how to use the social media. You know, and of course, this doesn't happen in the United States. They don't spend $15 million a year in the U.S. to teach U.S. youth how to use social media. I mean, you know, that's the other thing. You got to have the corporate media on your side if you want to have a coup like this, if you want to change the government. One thing that, you know, Occupy didn't understand is that U.S. media, CNN, NBC, even PBS, NPR are not going to be on their side. Okay, so Occupy had a very peaceful demonstration. It wasn't like these Venezuelan protests. Occupy was very peaceful, and you know, it wasn't funded from outside. It was a grassroots enterprise there. But the problem was, the media, first of all, sat on the story for weeks. So they had been occupying various areas, and you didn't hear about it at all. I had to use social media to get it out to people I knew. So for weeks and weeks, it was as if it wasn't happening. And when it became undeniable because of social media and the spread of information, then you started to get coverage, and there was always coverage with the opposite side and always coverage right. talking to the police and so on. And they didn't say anything when the police systematically, in a coordinated fashion, wiped out a number of Occupy encampments until it was all over. So Occupy did not have the U.S. media on their side. But in Venezuela, you know, the protesters know that they can act and get the media, the United States media, the so-called international community, which is the United States, Canada, France, whatever, to be on their side. And that's how it works. So there can be protests of any sort happening in other places in the world, but there's going to be the focus put on the Venezuelan protests. And it just means that there's going to be pressure put on the government of Venezuela automatically when that happens. So, you know, they can act knowing that they're going to have allies in the form of foreign media, and it's going to put the government on the spot, and the violence that's conducted by the government, if it happens at all, is going to be highlighted, spotlighted, and they usually have figures they can, people that they can focus on, and these cases, victims, whatever. So this has been a common strategy, and you've mentioned it in reference to other countries. It always seems too that you often have these mysterious snipers come about and shoot into a crowd if there's no violence, and then suddenly they can say, look, the government's repressed people, now it's time to fight back. People have to start really scrutinizing these sorts of things. There was a pretty good response here in North America to what was happening in Venezuela, and you had writers going to Counterpunch and Black Agenda Report and so on, getting that information out. But still, if you're just sitting there watching the TV, all you're going to think is, oh, look at this violence in Venezuela. Oh, that's a shame. Oh, look at that government, what it's doing. And so, you know, you've got to get out there, and you've got to read Black Agenda Report, I guess.
And people have to also be able to scrutinize, be able to really deconstruct what they're hearing or what they're not hearing or reading or what they're not reading in the corporate media. For instance, if we really pay attention to a lot of what the media, CNN and these people, they're saying, they might say, you know, that there's government, they'll say there's government repression, but then if they mention a specific incident, like they'll mention how many people are dead or so many people got shot, they will never say who shot them. They won't say the government killed this person, because that's something they have to back up. They could just imply it. And just by implying it, and people say, oh, this person, first if you mention that there's government repression against the demonstration, you just say it, you don't say anything, and then in the next sentence you say, so-and-so people, you know, got killed, three people were killed by gunfire. You didn't say that the government killed them, but you did imply it by how they crafted the language. Do you see what I'm saying?
Well, yes. I mean, a lot of it is the way they frame an issue or slant coverage or use certain words, and you have to be careful about that trickiness, which will definitely occur when they talk about countries like Venezuela. I guess the other thing, though, is they straight-out lie sometimes, too. You have a number of reports in the U.S. media saying that, oh, the government has shut down the only remaining opposition channel or something like that, which is just ridiculous. If you've ever been there or if you talk to anyone there, you know there's multiple channels for the opposition, because you're talking about the private media. There still is a 1% there. They still own lots of radio stations, TV stations, newspapers.
They own the majority. In fact, the government only has the public station, and then they have on their side the community stations, radio stations that have they funded and given people the access to be able to create their own community. So they are largely in support of the government. But in terms of the major media on television, that's all private, largely anti-government stations.
And the stuff they say on there, too, I mean, they make ridiculous allegations, right? They'll say things like, the Cuban government, the Venezuelan government is working with the Cubans to hide an invasion force, and they're going to do this, and they put stuff in the light bulbs to watch you. I mean, you know, if U.S. broadcasters report this kind of stuff, they probably have a SWAT team sent in against them. But, you know, the Venezuelan opposition just makes all sorts of outrage.
They'll call for the death of the president. They did that under Chavez. They were calling for it. I mean, I've been there and heard. So I was kind of taken aback by watching the television saying, what? You know, they actually allow them, because I'm thinking, if I was running the government, I wouldn't allow that on there. So, you know, I guess they call me repressive because I go in and shut that down. Well, yeah. But, you know, like you said,
it brings up an important point about Venezuela, and it seems to be the most democratic country in the hemisphere. I mean, they've had so many elections at the national level, including referendums and things like that. The media there, the level of discourse, I've only been there once, but I can tell you can find all sorts of people willing to volunteer their opinion about whether they're pro-government, pro-Chavez, pro-Maduro, or if they're in the opposition. Everyone's talking about it. There's graffiti everywhere. People express themselves. They don't feel afraid to express themselves. They feel encouraged to express themselves and take part in the political process. process. And then you have this diversity that's reflected in the media, which we don't see here, as I said, in a sleepy country like Canada especially. So it just seems to me that if there's ever an example of a country that actually is more democratic than what we have here, you're not going to hear about it from our news.
Right, and it would be Venezuela. And like you say, I mean, I would say, in terms of being from the U.S. and just making the comparison, there's no right to national referendums in the United States. None. The United States can, and I don't know about Venezuela's, what you call National Assembly and how that is, but here, you know, the United States, the President of the United States can veto a decision from the Congress, you know, those kind of things. They select its cabinet and all those kind of things. Well, and I don't know how it is in Venezuela if they select appoint ministers. I know in Cuba they usually call them a dictatorship, but the president doesn't have the right to select the ministers in the cabinet. They're elected officials as well, elected by the National Assembly. And so there's all kinds of things. They can't veto a decision by the National Assembly. There's differences in the situation in the government. So how we measure and compare what is or what isn't a quote-unquote democracy is much more complicated, and especially the generalization, well, this is a democracy, this is not, as opposed to there's democratic processes or more democratic processes in place in this place versus that place, is much more a nuanced way to analyze things.
Yeah, I don't think electoral democracy or representative democracy is the highest form of democracy, but at least by those standards, Venezuela is extensively
right.
Democratic. And it's just funny when they use this sort of script, this recycled script, where they say, oh, you know, this autocratic country, this dictatorship, this failing socialist state. They have a script that bears no relation to reality, and they can say it if no one challenges them.
Right. And one of the things that we're hearing over again recently is that the questioning of Maduro's election, the election of Nicolas Maduro in last year in April in 2000, they're bringing this up. You know, it was coming up then, the challenger, Capriles, who lost the election, didn't want to recognize the results and was claiming that it was rigged. Now, in Venezuela, they have a much more transparent process for verifying elections than any place else in the world. In fact, Jimmy Carter dubbed it the most transparent electoral system in the world and the best in the world. And so in Venezuela, voters, they register at polling stations by thumbprint. Then their ballots are cast electronically in the computers, which a lot of times, you know, you're skeptical of the use of electronic voting. But in this sense, the way the Venezuelans use it, it actually leaves very little room for corruption. So that while they use the computers, the people who cast their vote by computer receive a paper receipt listing the name of the candidate that they voted for. They, before leaving the polling station, which is where people, they get the receipt and they think that verifies things, but it doesn't. So before leaving them, you don't know what's registered inside the computer based on, you know, what just the receipt. But what they do in Venezuela is before leaving the polling station, they turn in the receipt into a designated box. And then 54% of those polling stations are undergo an audit process, which they count the paper receipts are separated by candidates, counted by hand and recounted, and then checked against the electronic polling results. And so that's a 54% audit that's already done, you know, automatically in the elections. And then, of course, you can call for another, you know, audit if, like, a candidate has a dispute. Now, when they sign off on this, of course, all the parties are involved. I mean, they have their own observers. So these things, the results for each polling station are signed off on by representatives from each party. So it's not like you can say, you know, it's only controlled, you know, by one, you know, by the government or something like that.
And yet you have northern politicians, you know, complaining about the legitimacy of the Venezuelan government or asking if the elections are legitimate. You know, here in Canada, I mean, people need to ask themselves how many legitimate elections Stephen Harper and the current government has won. I mean, we're being investigated. The federal government's been investigated. And the truth is maybe we should have South American election monitors sent up to Canada, the United States. I know we've both had some serious problems in the last 10 years, and we're getting tired of this finger wagging. Anyway, thanks for giving us your time on this. You know, I enjoyed the article. It was detailed, and we can probably look forward to more articles about Venezuela from you and others on Black Agenda Reports. So thanks again for being with us today.
Thank you, Brendan.
Thanks. Bye-bye. And that was Netva Freeman. And as I said earlier, Netva is an activist and he's a writer. He writes for Black Agenda Report. You can find one of his articles. It's a few days back probably on page 2 or 3 of Black Agenda Report. Netva Freeman had an article about Venezuela and those movements.